The U.S. command in Saigon said no American battle deaths were reported in Indochina yesterday. Assuming there are no delayed casualty reports from remote outposts, that would be the first day that the war has not claimed an American life since June. In Cambodia, scattered clashes were reported in the area around Srang, 26 miles south of Phnom Penh. That district town, taken by the communists last Sunday, was reoccupied yesterday by the Cambodians. We have a report from Jed Duval.
That's the advance line of Cambodian troops. On the fifth day of the battle for Srang, they have retaken it. It is a crossroads town, empty of people, and apparently empty of the North Vietnamese enemy. It was done in a walk. For days, the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese had easily held back the timid government troops. But the communists had retreated from the town by the time reinforced Cambodian units began this sweep towards Srang. For more than a mile, they walked, an unworried throng, the leading squads firing as if they had an unlimited supply of ammunition, which they don't. Any bush or building that might hide a Viet Cong was a target. Mortar shells were flung ahead of the column in the general direction of where the enemy might be. The attacking Cambodians walked past the bodies of a few of their own men, killed last Sunday in the communist attack that first took Srang. In 2 hours of shooting, there was one casualty, a Cambodian soldier who said a Viet Cong sniper hit him. He was treated by one of the nurses who marched with this army. The sound of the firing may have been deafening, but it was in part deceiving, since some of it was target practice on the local coconuts. Since the communists gave up Srang without a fight and probably could get it back with ease, then it wasn't much of a victory for the Cambodians, but it was nevertheless a victory, something this army doesn't get very often. Jed Duval, CBS News, Srang, Cambodia.
How about that new Kent menthol?
Wow, Kent got it all together.
Kent got it all together.
Kent has got it all together.
New Kent Menthol 100s. Brisk, breezy menthol flavor, exclusive micronite filter, and good rich taste. They're all together now.
All the refreshment of menthol.
Folks, that was Jed Duval reporting from Srang in this new front of the Vietnam War in Cambodia. And what did you notice from that story? What would you have thought if you were watching that with your dinner back in 1970? Hearing about these Cambodian government troops walking, blasting their guns in all directions as if they had infinite ammo. Target practice on coconut trees in between stepping over the dead bodies of fallen soldiers who had died in combat. But for a village that was not even still occupied by the communists anymore. The report ends with such a patronizing pat on the head, acknowledging that the Cambodian troops had barely won a battle against an enemy which was clearly in control of the war, could come and go as they pleased. It was like congratulating a child who had finally knocked over a bowling pin on their 10th attempt. And while it's certainly an oversimplification and harsh generalization to judge the entire Cambodian military as inept, well, let's just say that there were reasons why this angle to the reporting had become established. It was something we noted in the first episode of this season with New York Times journalist Henry Kam's coverage of the fighting, as it had almost engulfed Phnom Penh in just the first few weeks of the war. I described it as this underlying feeling of unseriousness, even though, as we've just heard in that report, these are men stepping over dead bodies on the way to battle. This is a war that would decide the fate of the country. This was life and death. It was war. I found some reports from June 1970 that showed both sides of this, the hopelessness, the unreality, the reluctant Americans, the optimistic yet resigned Cambodians, and the seemingly no-nonsense, long-term strategy of the battle-hardened communists. Firstly, the daily briefings for journalists by the Cambodian military spokesman were from the unfortunately named Major M. Rong, which if you were writing a satire, you might even doubt whether that was too obvious a joke to be funny. Beginning on June 8th, the New York Times begins running stories about the battle for Siem Reap. The headline was, "Cambodians battle enemy at city near Angkor Wat." The airport had fallen briefly before being retaken by government troops. The provincial capital seemed as if it was surrounded. 9 battalions were rushed there. Paratroopers were flown in. One of the more striking stories that came out of the reporting on this ongoing battle involved a Viet Cong assault on a high school. It was there that some 200 students, most of them 16 or 17 years old, had been recently inducted into the army, and the school had become their garrison. An officer in radio contact with them over the course of the night of the assault described them crying constantly like they were children calling for their mothers. But they did hold on. Only two had died, a girl and a teacher. But the much stronger force had eventually retreated, for now. It was the case with many of the provincial capitals across the country, open to constant attacks and cut off from the major highways to Phnom Penh. The countryside was crawling with Viet Cong and North Vietnamese armies, particularly by June, when Nixon's limited invasion, or as he called it, the incursion, had resulted in the communists moving westward from the sanctuaries on the border that he had hoped to eliminate. But Siem Reap was different. Just outside the city lay the famous Angkorian temples, and the symbol of Cambodian sovereignty and nation. On June 11th, the New York Times reported that communist troops had now seized control of the surrounding countryside, including Angkor. Major M. Rong, briefing the press, had initially said that the army had made plans to defend Angkor. Now, with the temples in enemy hands, he updated the situation, saying that they still had plans, but no means. It was now beyond their means to take the temples back. If someone was reading the New York Times that morning with their bacon and eggs, someone with perhaps even a tangential knowledge of the gravity of the situation, how big a deal it was that Angkor was in Vietnamese communist control, which was, you know, even cultural significance aside, if you look at a map of Cambodia, Angkor is practically on the opposite side of the Vietnamese border. These articles were describing the highway being severed to Thailand, and everyone knew that the American troops were leaving on the 30th of June. Nixon's hands had been tied, the catch-22 of having to do something about Cambodia to stop what might have been its total capitulation to the Vietnamese communists in those crazy days in April. Well, he had invaded, but only within a certain distance, and only within a certain time limit. And even then, the backlash had been immense. But before putting your paper down to finish your orange juice while you're reading the paper, you would have seen another article about the war in Cambodia. One that found a place for the absurd and unserious. If, you know, a high school full of 17-year-olds who had been hastily recruited as soldiers trying to fight off the Viet Cong hadn't been jarring enough, well, at the same time that Angkor had been lost to the communists, there had been another casualty. Pepsi Cola, a casualty of the Cambodian conflict, the article's headline read. Deliveries were down 60%. Pepsi, which had been introduced in Cambodia in 1963, 2 years before Coca-Cola, and thus becoming the number one beverage in the country. But now, nearly half of their delivery trucks had either been commandeered by Lon Nol's army for hauling troops and weapons, and another 40 trucks had been blown up in rocket attacks or other accidents. In fact, it seemed that the communists knew to target the blue, white, red logo on the trucks, and that the word Pepsi had become a phrase used by the communists to describe the often occurring secondary explosions when the truck's cargo of ammunition was hit by their rounds. If that wasn't enough dry humour included in the article, and I'm not sure if I'm reading this next bit exactly right, I'm pretty sure the subtext is there, but it's like a nod to the whole concept of Vietnamisation of the wars and getting Americans out, which was Nixon's primary strategy and one of the main reasons that Cambodia had been invaded back in April. But this Pepsi article says that the bottling facility was having a routine inspection done. However, the inspector had been recently replaced. It had previously been an American guy from San Francisco, but he'd been replaced with a Chinese inspector from Hong Kong. When this inspector was asked about the change, he said, with a laugh, "Ugh, Asia for the Asians," suggesting that even Pepsi Corporation could see the writing on the wall here. So this was June 1970. The Americans wrapping up their brief incursion, the communists had taken Angkor, Lon Nol's army was seen as a bit of a joke, and Pepsi deliveries were down 60%. Phnom Penh was still managing to exist in a kind of bubble. clinging to its reputation as the Pearl of Southeast Asia. The war was still elsewhere, but the Vietnam War, like a flash flood, had quickly risen above the banks of the river and had washed across the whole country, unstoppable. And it was in the following weeks that the new Cambodian government were going to have to try and do something. They had to prove to their own army, their own people, and the Americans, and the world watching, that they could get a handle on this disaster. That they could get out there, into those flood borders, start rescuing people, start putting down the sandbags, and getting their country sorted out. At the end of June, just a day before the American troop withdrawal on the 30th, Lon Nol held a press conference at the Defense Ministry in Phnom Penh. He was asked by a reporter whether he thought that, overall, the US incursion had been a good thing. To this question, he thought briefly and looked across to Sirik Mattack, his deputy and primary co-conspirator in the parliamentary coup which had ended Sihanouk's rule of the country 3 months prior. The deputy premier met Lon Nol's look and gave an affirmative nod. Lon Nol then returned his gaze back to the press and affirmatively said, in French to a translator, "Yes, I believe it has been favourable." He went on to agree with the primary selling points that Nixon had discussed when he announced the incursion to the American public, that the communist border sanctuaries had needed to be eliminated. He also said that he hoped the US Air Force would continue to fly supportive combat missions in Cambodia, and that if the military situation got particularly bad, he hoped that the departed US ground troops would return. The actual article that this conference was reported in made it clear that the American sources they had, well, they were saying that there was no expectation that the US troops would return. And it is this point of seeming naivety on behalf of Lon Nol which is interesting, particularly in relation to someone like Sirik Mattack, who I've come to consider as kind of, well, it's an oversimplification, but he's kind of like the brains of the duo, at least at this point in the story. And Lon Nol presented the brawn, not physically, but via the deep personal loyalties that he commanded in the Cambodian army, not to mention the patronage that goes both ways there, by the way, which had been a decisive factor in them being able to execute the removal of Sihanouk. But if we are to reduce Sirik Mattack and Lon Nol to this brains and brawn kind of cliche, well, Lon Nol also has this very emotional aspect to him as well. He's a complicated guy. For instance, I wonder if, in his own mind, when he was asked this question about whether the US incursion had been favourable overall, if for just a moment he'd been transported back in time only a month prior, when he had discussed this with Nixon's chief of staff, General Alexander Haig. Lon Nol had told Haig that his new government had burned their bridges when they got rid of Sihanouk, that they were desperate, and that there was simply no way that the Cambodian army could stop the communists. His country was in danger. Only the American army could help. William Shawcross records what happened next in his book, Sideshow. Quote, "When he had finished talking, Haig began. He informed Lon Nol that President Nixon intended to limit the involvement of American forces in Cambodia. They would be withdrawn at the end of June. Then the president hoped to introduce a program of restricted economic and military aid. As the implications of Haig's words for the future of Cambodia became clear to Lon Nol, he began to weep. Cambodia, he said, could never defend itself. Unable to control his emotions, he walked across to the window and stood there, his shoulders shaking, his face turned away from Haig. Haig then went across the room to try to comfort the general. He put his arm around his shoulder and promised him, through the interpreter, that President Nixon supported him and would give him what help he could, despite the political constraints in Washington." End quote. And spare a thought for the poor interpreter in that situation. Lon Nol's response is also included in Haig's memo that was sent through Kissinger to Nixon. It said, quote, "Lon Nol is very emotional and not very realistic. Towards the end of the conversation, he broke down. It would prove fatal to his government if he were to continue to expect a massive infusion of US assistance." End quote. Now, how we read all of this and how we make sense of it all is kind of interesting, because one of the big themes that we will see throughout the whole Cambodian Civil War is this kind of conflicting views that about what was sort of expected from each partner in this new wartime relationship. I've already said in an early episode that I think the idea of Cambodia being a side show to the Vietnam War and this understanding that is developed on top of that one very persuasive word, more or less just based on Shawcross's book, or the title at least, is that it really underplays how important the Americans did think Cambodia was to their whole strategy of the end of the Vietnam War. How did I describe it? Something like, if it's a sideshow, well, it's one that is compulsory viewing in order to understand the main event. Now, I'll also say, just as a quick aside, that if we are talking sideshows, then Cambodia isn't just a sideshow to the Americans, but also to the Vietnamese communists. If it is all just a cynical game of using other parties in order to achieve your own self-interest, then the Americans are certainly not alone on that front. But getting back to that relationship between the US and the Lon Nol regime, I think it is a complicated one. I think if it were like a couple, then you'd get the impression that the Cambodians are almost acting as if they've found a partner that they're going to marry. They're sure they're going to get married. They're even looking at four-bedroom houses that they can move into, calling up the bank and inquiring about a home loan. And meanwhile, the other partner here, the US, well, it's like they're in this relationship, but they're constantly talking about the possibility of seeing other people. That this isn't exactly a long-term thing. But every now and again, they're also giving the impression that, you know what? Maybe they could get married. They're sending mixed messages. Like for Lon Nol, in that meeting, he breaks down crying. And Haig tells him, you know, hand on the shoulder, Nixon is going to support you. And I don't want to stretch this metaphor beyond recognition, but if this were, you know, a couple where one is falling madly in love and the other one is still, you know, unsure, well, there's another very important factor. The United States has parents that are completely against them getting married. They won't allow it. And that is the Congress, which is becoming increasingly wary of the possibility that this war might go on and on. They've seen how the Gulf of Tonkin resolution ended up with 500,000 troops in Vietnam, and they weren't going to let that happen again. And it was in direct response to Nixon's incursion that a committee led by Senator Frank Church and Senator Sherman Cooper began to make moves that would eventuate in a bill that would permanently ban the re-entry of US ground troops or military advisors for use in Cambodia. It would become known as the Cooper-Church Amendment and basically act as a kind of padlock on Nixon's ability to wage war in Cambodia. So when Haig tells Lon Nol, like, yeah, we've got your back, despite the political constraints in Washington, you have to wonder about which part of that Lon Nol really heard. This is the partner who is choosing to ignore some signs, but at the same time is still being told things that make them think, nah, we are going to get married one day. And perhaps this imagery isn't quite adequate, but maybe it's a way to frame the complexities of the Cambodian-American cooperation for this war, where it does have some of the features of a really unhealthy relationship, if we put it that way, in that it isn't as simple as it might appear from the outside. It didn't obey logic all the time, and it was always likely to end in pain. Once the US troops were gone, and remember the South Vietnamese still left upwards of 30,000 troops in Cambodia, and the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese probably still had more than 50,000 spread across the country now. But once the US troops left at the end of June, this did produce a moment to pause for all parties. You'll recall, my dear listener, in the last episode, this was actually the period where Pol Pot had come back into the country and was looking to organize the Khmer Rouge and their new combat relationship with the Vietnamese. But this time we're just sticking with the Cambodian government side of things. And it was a Cambodian Lieutenant General Sak Sutsakan who wrote a military history of this period, who summed up the war until this pause had occurred. Quote, by about May 1970, it was clear that the capital of Phnom Penh was, in effect, surrounded on three sides by territory in the hands of the enemy. Even the fall of Phnom Penh seemed plausible. However, the US South Vietnamese cross-border operations and the combined Cambodian Republican and South Vietnamese operations during May and June led to a period of stability by the month of July. The enemy appeared to pause to recondition his units and receive reinforcements. The initial strategic concept developed for the defense of the Khmer Republic took this situation into account. End quote. This sequence of events is also neatly outlined, along with the rest of the Civil War, by Craig Etchison in his book The Rise and Demise of Democratic Kampuchea. And he has this interesting way of laying it out in the form of a, quote, dreary seven-act play, where the first act is the initial collapse, lasting from the 20th of March to June 30th, 1970. That's what we've covered in the first few episodes of this season. Then the second act is retrenchment, counterattack, and parry, which lasts from July 1, 1970 to August 20, 1971. That is what we're covering in this episode. The third act he titles Blunder, which lasts until the end of that year, followed by the fourth act, Attrition, the fifth act, Attack and Repulse, which lasts until August 1973, then the sixth act, Siege, which ends in December 1974, and finally, the last act, The Kill, which takes us from January 1st, 1975 to April 17th, 1975. So, if we go off Suksukan's account there, we're still early in this tragedy. The first acts are only just playing out, according to Etchison, and in mid-1970, the Cambodian government was taking stock after a chaotic first 3 months in power. 3 months where it wouldn't be overstating things to conclude that they had lost half of the country to the communists. The scale of the problem set in, and with the American troops gone, it was now time for Lon Nol to turn up with a strategy. They still had Phnom Penh, they still had much of the west of the country, on the southern side of the Great Lake toward Battambang. And Battambang was very important. That region produced about 70% of the country's rice, and it's like the second or third largest city. And they still had some of the other provincial capitals as well. But, like in Siem Reap, the countryside surrounding them was crawling with the enemy, and quite often the major arterial highways out of Phnom Penh that connected these capitals to the government were cut off, or unsafe to travel on. It was the height of the wet monsoon season, steamy morning hazes and late afternoon downpours, and the communists controlled all of eastern and much of northern Cambodia, sections of the central east, the southwest, and the highlands in the south. It was at this point that the Cambodian leadership, under Lon Nol, but with men like Siriakmatak behind the scenes, put forward a simple kind of war plan. It became known as the Lon Nol Line. And you can basically imagine this as drawing a big diagonal slash across the map of Cambodia, from the Fishhook area on the Vietnamese border, up through Kampong Cham, northwest towards Kampong Thom and Siem Reap, and eventually meeting the Thai border. Everything south of that line was what they were going to try and hold, and north of that line, well, for now, they were giving it up. The plan itself had three phases. Phase 1, survive south of the line. Phase 2, consolidate that territory. And phase 3, the ambitious phase that was probably written in the spirit of, we can get to that later, was retake the territory north of the line. Not too far away from planning out winning a football game by saying, okay, first we try not to concede any goals, then we score some goals, and finally, we win. And that, you know, might sound a bit silly, but that is how you win football games. And it's in Etchison's book that he kind of says that about the Lon Nol line strategy. In a way, it's not a bad plan, because most of the population centres, the main rice-producing areas, and the agricultural heart of Cambodia still sat south of that line. But of course, the real question was whether they could pull it off. The Cambodian army had grown from about 30,000 men to over 60,000, thanks to mass recruitment and a huge influx of American financial and military aid. Morale did need a boost, though. The army needed a win, and the economy desperately needed to recapture some of the farmland and territory that was under communist control. At the same time, the Americans were also eager to see their new ally go on the offensive. Cambodia had effectively become a test case for Nixon's broader Vietnamization strategy, what he'd outlined in 1969 as the so-called Nixon Doctrine. The United States would provide aid, training, and air support, but the actual fighting, that would be up to America's allies. And for Lon Nol, That meant finding a way to show Washington that Cambodia could hack it, to borrow Nixon's own phrase. Wilfred Dyack described the Lon Nol regime as a bloodied, groggy combatant that had been saved by the bell after being mauled during the first round. Now they were sat down, getting cleaned up, and organizing a response. And that brings us to the first serious attempt by the Cambodians to take the fight back to the communists, an operation that would become known as Chen La One. It was bold, ambitious, and on paper, not a bad idea. But in practice, it would also reveal exactly how fragile this new war effort really was, and set the tone for the rest of the conflict. The objective of Chen La, or the full title was Chen La De Tuk, which was named after the pre-Angkorian states, perhaps a slight nod to Lon Nol's obsession with the past, as well as the Khmer words for land and water, because both elements were going to be important to its success. But this military operation was fairly straightforward in theory. And it's useful to visualize this, so if you don't have a working mental map of the country, feel free to have a look at an actual map. I'll leave a link to some helpful images and maps on the website in the episode description, so feel free to pop those up now if you can. Otherwise, just visualize National Road 6. This heads up north out of Phnom Penh. You could also, it's like Highway 6, Route 6, it's interchangeable. But this goes north out of Phnom Penh, and to the northwest of that, you've got the Tonle Sap River, which eventually meets the Great Lake, and to the northeast of the highway you've got the Mekong River. Now, if you travel on Route 6 out of Phnom Penh, and I suppose it's worth saying there's a chance that someone might be on holiday or, you know, in Cambodia right now, maybe they're on their way on a bus to Siem Reap or something, so if that's you, you know, look out the window, because you are looking at what used to be a war zone, you know. But if you head north from Phnom Penh on Route 6, after about 50 miles you'll hit the town of Skoon. This town becomes a kind of forward base for Operation Chen La. From there, if you keep on Route 6, about halfway between Phnom Penh and Siem Reap is the provincial capital of Kampong Tom. Allied air power had kept Kampong Tom from falling to the communists, but it was still being hit by ground assaults and mortar fire regularly. So the overall goal of Chen La One was to open up a land route to Kampong Tom so you can relieve that pressure. The offensive involved three parts. Two parts were conducted on the roads that lead to the provincial capital, particularly the ones that converge on a village that is on the way to Kampong Tom. It has a similar name, Kampong Tmar. Another part of the offensive would go straight to Kampong Tom via the Sen River, which is a tributary of the Tonle Sap. I know this is an audio medium, but if you're looking at the map I've given you, this is going to make a lot more sense. But in essence, you've got two roads that converge at Kampong Tmar. And the objective is to take that and then keep on going on one road up to Kampong Tom. Highway 6 makes one side of a kind of triangle-shaped area, starting with Skoon on the western bottom corner, connected by a road on the bottom of the triangle that gets to Kampong Cham in the east, that's Route 7, and this other route north to Kampong Tmar at the top. So you get this triangle of territory, right? And the goal was to secure the whole triangle by traveling up both roads at once with several thousand troops, backed up with artillery, tanks, armored personnel carriers, air power, basically the government's best foot forward. This wasn't just made up of the 24-hour soldiers that had been hastily recruited and sent to the battlefield in that initial craze of nationalism and optimism in the wake of the coup. They were even sending in battalions of Khmer Krom soldiers who had fought in South Vietnam, and they'd be able to call on South Vietnamese and American airstrikes as well. So, like I said, this is sort of the best that Lon Nol can put out there. Now, if you're not looking at a map, that's totally fine. Just imagine the idea being these massive columns of Cambodian troops moving up a two-lane asphalt road, up a highway, evenly spaced out, and slowly going up, you know, it's 40 miles of highway, clearing out the towns and villages of enemies along the way until they reach this major town. And if they can secure all of that, well, then they've re-established control of the highway, they've got access to this fertile farmland, and they are hopefully disrupting communist supply routes that are feeding the war in Cambodia and in South Vietnam. It was being led by Brigadier General Colonel Savut, who Diak describes as short, cane-wielding, and eccentric. And there was a kind of festive feel about the troops arriving into Skun in late August. Soldiers disembarking the mishmash of brightly coloured buses, army green military vehicles, and who knows, maybe even the occasional Pepsi delivery truck, right? The soldiers' uniforms and accessories were also a mix, strapped under or on top of the tiger stripes of tan, green and grey, or standard olive green outfits, were symbols of the culture that was going to war. Many of them sporting amulets and tattoos that had been imbued with protective powers, scarves blessed by monks, and small bags worn on necklaces that contained small ivory Buddhas or coins bearing ancient Hindu figures. Much of this paraphernalia was welcomed by Lon Nol, who was himself consulting mystics and looking to the ancient past for inspiration about this very modern war. And I realise this comes up a fair bit in these discussions about this sort of part of the war, and I don't want to make it seem, you know, too exotic and spooky, which can often be the subtext here, but, you know, if someone objectively explained the idea that the son of a deity who was tortured was, you know, symbolized on a cross-shaped piece of silver and brought along by plenty of American troops to Vietnam, people might think that was a little strange too, but, you know, I guess we all have our superstitions. That being said, when it comes to Lon Nol, perhaps he will go a little too far into the exotic, but we'll get into more detail there at a later time. The 1st Battalions moved out from Skun on September 7th. They were enthusiastic as the column began inching up Highway 6. But they, you know, they head out and they have a US spotter plane ahead of them, and the first village on the road that they want to get to is called Prakam, and it takes them about 3 days to get there. They had been slowed down by bridges that had been destroyed, trenches dug across the road, trees being used to block the highway, but there was no enemy troops stopping them, yet. About halfway between Skun and Kampong Tma on Highway 6, remember that's forming one side of this triangle, halfway up that road was Tang Kauk, and it was a few miles out from this town that the Cambodian government troops met their first real resistance. As Wilfred Diak points out in his book, Road to the Killing Fields, you have to remember that this was the height of the monsoon season, yeah? And Highway 6 is kind of raised above the ground level. It's like a couple of feet built up. And for large stretches of this highway, you've basically got rice paddy on either side for miles. And in the rainy season, that doesn't make for an especially easy terrain, right? You're essentially, you've got flood waters on either side of you. So the road, that almost becomes like a railway. And the battalions of troops and armour and artillery, they can't easily go outside of that track. They can really only go forwards or backwards. If there's an obstacle, it's very difficult to sort of go around it. You can't move laterally. So this presents a problem that will come up a few times in Chen La 1, and in this first instance, approaching Tang Kauk, they need to be able to repair the bridge in front of them while bearing mortar fire. And if you were there and you could look to the east and west of, you know, the two-lane road that the troops are on, aside from the acres of muddy and waterlogged rice paddy, you can also make out little embankments of tree cover in the distance where these attacks can stem from. The kind of phrasing that Diak will often use to describe the communist attempts at repelling the government troops is pecking. Words like pecking. You can imagine peck, 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 all at different little angles. And aside from having some of these fortified positions, they will be able to come out and hit various parts of this spaced out, you know, almost like a line of ants, right? You can hit the front to slow it down, the back to catch it unaware, and the sides to cause chaos. Eventually, the column can move forward, and the fortified bunkers and trenches that the communists were firing on them from are dispatched by calling in airstrikes. It was around this time that a captured communist soldier provided information about a large concentration of forces that were going to ambush them. By September 14th, the column had still not reached Tangkhak. And remember, this is only, you know, halfway up the highway to Kampong Tma, which is the objective. There are waves of communist attacks that are fought back, but the column is only inching toward the outskirts of Tangkhak. A bridge behind them is destroyed, and the civilians sent to try and repair it are attacked by the communists. It was becoming a wet, trudging clash on Route 6. The other part of the offensive, the one that was going to go up the Tonle Sap River, then up one of the tributaries, the Sen River, to get to Kampong Tom via water, that's faring much better. They were able to get troops into Kampong Tom, as well as ferry back hundreds of refugees that had been stuck in the town. And though the defense of the town was shored up with reinforcements and supplies, the prospect of actually clearing out from it, pushing back the communists and completing a kind of pincer movement that would sync up with the Chenla column on Route 6, was seemingly not going to happen, considering how slow progress had been on the road. By the time that Lon Nol personally arrived at Skun, fresh Cambodian government troops had already been thrown behind the already large number that was approaching Tangkhok, bringing the total to more than 7,000. The troops being sent now were no longer of the, you know, well-trained, best-foot-forward kind that had initially started out. Some days they would suffer dozens of wounded and routinely lose handfuls of men. Taking Tangkhak had become paramount, and the offensive resumed on September 22nd. There had been a slight change in tactics, however. Paratroopers and infantrymen managed to go around the village to the east and north, eventually getting behind it. Others waded through the paddies west so that they could create a flanking movement. Smoke rockets were fired to mark enemy strong points, and US and Khmer jets hit them. The combination of airstrikes, infantry, and paratroopers proved decisive. After 2 weeks, the communist resistance finally fell, and according to Nixon's daily presidential briefing on September 26th, the actual entry into the village itself was only met with light opposition. The government had suffered 43 dead and more than 300 wounded in the final drive to take the town, and announced that more than 300 Viet Cong or North Vietnamese soldiers had been killed. Taking Tangkhak was the first major victory of the war, although it was only halfway up Route 6 from Skun to Kampong Tma, the overall objective of Chenla. Over the next few days, Cambodian forces reorganized and consolidated at Tangkhak, but it became clear that this continued advance of the column up Route 6 would be unwise. Just to the northeast lay the Chamka Andong rubber plantations, one of the largest in the country. Back then, probably around 30 square miles, so a bit larger than the whole of Manhattan. Imagine that sitting toward the top of that triangle of territory this whole operation was taking place in, and it's marked on one of the images I've put for you to check. That was the Vietnamese primary base of operations, and they were setting up anti-aircraft guns to ensure that the continual pounding of that area wouldn't go unchallenged. It also meant that if you kept your line of ants going up that highway, well, soon you would be exposing your flanks to, you know, a whole nest of trouble hidden behind cover. There continued little pecking actions from the communists and the occasional sweep from the Chenla column eastward, but it did not move past Tangkhak, and the Vietnamese were able to attack elements that supported the column further back, or on different parts of the triangle, so toward Kampong Cham primarily, down the bottom corners. This had the effect of drawing off, piece by piece, battalions that made up the column, paralysing it at times, taking out bridges, forcing the troops to need to be supplied from the air. But, much like the reporter for NBC mentioned at the start of this episode, when these meandering soldiers had blasted through a village that was no longer being held by the Vietnamese, and that was still being hailed as a much-needed victory, well, Chenla, despite becoming kind of dormant, having only gone 14 miles from its starting position, and in reality having become a bit of a known quantity for the communists, you know, they had their eyes on the whole operation. They knew where they were. Still, Chen La, back in Phnom Penh at least, was being hailed as a massive victory by Lon Nol's government. My dear listener, that was just a sample of the Khmer Republic's new national anthem. And the Republic itself was declared in the wake of Chen La having been considered this great stride forward, despite still trying to just survive south of the Lon Nol line. The Republic was officially proclaimed on the 9th of October, but the day prior, Henry Kam's book includes an interesting, if not slightly cynical, look behind the scenes of the festivities and ceremony that took place. He describes someone named Madame Sim Song Lung, principal of the Lycee Nyeri Girls' High School. She was woken up by a call from an official informing her that the assembly had just finalized the design for the new Khmer Republic flag. Remember, this is the day before the ceremony to announce the republic. She was ordered to quickly organize making the flag that would be hoisted by the Prime Minister up the flagpole. She had also been told that it would need to be, in Kam's words, consecrated by Vestal Virgins, which may have explained why the government official had reached out to the principal of a girls' high school. She waited outside the market in the morning for the shops to open, quickly bought plenty of red, blue, and white satin, then rushing back to her school's assembly hall, where some University of Fine Arts students had also been gathered. Madame Sim Song Lung had also picked a bunch of students who, she presumed, met the Prime Minister's qualifications of being a Vestal Virgin, and they got to work cutting and stitching the fabric to create the Republic's flag. Now, the flag itself is blue, with the top left quadrant a red triangle, and within that, a representation of Angkor Wat, the temples primarily associated with the monarchy, which Lon Nol was about to abolish, and as we've mentioned, were in an area that had been occupied by the Vietnamese communists for the last 4 months at this point. In the top right-hand area of the flag were three white stars, the meaning of which seemingly had not been agreed upon. Some officials thought it meant liberty, equality, and fraternity. Others presumed it represented the three stars on Lon Nol's military uniform. Soon, the young girls fashioning the flag together were joined by monks who, according to Kam, improvised a ceremony to bless the flag like a theatrical director at a first rehearsal. 12 of the youngest girls present knelt around the flag holding lotus blossoms while monks chanted mantras. Eventually, the Master of Rites pronouncing the ceremony was over, the flag was appropriately blessed, and it was ready to be flown the next day outside the grassy area in front of the royal palace. Kam, who I take it was there on the 9th to witness the ceremony, records his thoughts as such, quote, "A tall pedestal was being erected in the middle of the lawn for a republican symbol yet to be devised," one of the colonels said, "and five principles were to be engraved onto the base. The principles were as yet unknown, and the pedestal remained blank the following morning when Lon Nol ran up the flag on its shaky pole. The Republican National Anthem was sounded for the first time in its new role. The snappy tune had been lifted from a French operetta of the 19th century. Lon Nol and Cyric Mattak, who in July had assumed unlimited powers for the duration of the anti-communist war, each received, served in a golden bowl, an additional general star. The entire ceremony was to have been conducted to the booming of a 101-gun salute fired from a gunboat on the river. It ended after 7 shots had been heard, the last misfired, injuring 5 sailors." End quote. The hastily put together ceremony was indicative of how the Hollow Republic had functioned so far, and would continue to function throughout its 4.5-year lifespan. In the first 6 months of the regime, much of the optimism that had initially greeted the removal of Sihanouk, who, let's not forget, had not presided over the most fair, functioning, or flourishing society, much of this initial wave of optimism had petered out, Already, the refugees fleeing the American bombing, or the Vietnamese communists, or indeed the South Vietnamese army's own brutish and larcenous activities in the country, had formed a visible contradiction to the idea that Phnom Penh remained separate from the war. Slums and shanty towns were erected out of what tin or wood can be found, and on the spacious sidewalks and well-tended gardens and promenades that had provided the city with its charm and good vibes, more closely resembling the grim and dreary fences and barbed wire which had grown in places like Saigon, and this was only the beginning. There were whole families living on the streets. Just like Chen La was being hailed as a victory, or the American incursion as an unequivocal success, or how the leadership from someone like Lon Nol was seemingly oblivious to the realities or extent to which the United States' support of their country really was, or making sure Vestal Virgins blessed the new flag, or the idea that the communist presence in the country represented an existential threat to the Khmer race, one that required an appropriate indulgence in the racially motivated massacres of Vietnamese civilians, it was all kind of hollow. It spoke to, again, this what I can only describe as unseriousness, and a grim indictment of what can happen when leadership can become detached from the attempt to interact with reality and the truth. And it was also just blundering into things. Even the decision to announce the Republic, in effect ending more than 1,000 years of monarchy, this seemed like another decision with little thought given to it. Sihanouk had been sentenced to death in absentia, again another decision that failed to take into account his capacity for vengeance and his appeal to most Cambodians outside of the cities, but, you know, why not just consider him a traitor and announce a new monarch? One that could be pliant to the new regime but still maintain this thread of such profound importance to the culture of the country. Keeping this intact so that you didn't so glaringly give credence to the idea that the new government was simply lackeys of some foreign influence which was actively turning areas of the countryside into large craters, falling so easily into the hands of the communist propagandists. Again, I'm really trying not to paint with such a broad brush here. There are many people that will make up the governance of the Khmer Republic or its army who do not deserve to be portrayed in these terms. But the man at the top, Lon Nol, and the increasing influence of his brother, Lon Non, had begun to elbow aside the more capable politicians and leaders, even Sirik Mattak, and much of the administrative apparatus was coming under the control of this unstable and unlikely command. They will clumsily carry the government toward the caricature that it is often represented as. For instance, a few days prior to the ceremony and celebrations that marked the establishment of the Republic on October 9th, the Defense Ministry had published a paper which envisioned the need and goal for an armed force of more than 600,000 troops, more than 20 times the number they had at the start of 1970. Again, it was just unrealistic. A conversation between Hang Nhor, recorded in his memoir, and he was a practicing doctor at the time, and a reporter named Sam Quill, reflects how some of the Cambodians of Phnom Penh were beginning to see what was going on. Quote, "The newspaper reporter told me, the only reason Lon Nol was promoted was that Sihanouk knew he was stupid. Sihanouk didn't see him as a rival. And it really is true that Lon Nol is incompetent. He takes civilians off the streets, gives them 24 hours of training, personally sees to it that they're given Buddha amulets to wear and sends them off to fight the North Vietnamese. What's wrong with Buddha amulets?" I said. "You're a Buddhist, I'm a Buddhist. You work in the hospitals," he said sarcastically. "Do you see any proof that Buddha amulets can stop bullets from an AK-47? Under his fierce glare, I dropped my eyes and admitted that badly wounded soldiers with religious tattoos and charms came into the hospital all the time. "Lon Nol is crazy," Quill said earnestly. "I know. I followed him around. He's going to get a lot of innocent people killed, and then he's going to rely on the Americans for weapons and airstrikes to keep the regime from falling. Take my word for it, my friend. He's stupid. Stupid. I tell you. He started a war, but he will not be able to defend the country." End quote. While Chen La had stalled north of Phnom Penh, the armies of the Republic would venture out to other areas south of the Lon Nol line to attempt to consolidate their territory as part of the overall strategy that had been adopted. Communist attacks southwest of the capital prompted a lieutenant general to muster some 30,000 troops of the new Republic's army to head out on Route 4 to mount some kind of offensive. Now, that might sound pretty good. That's a lot of troops, right? But it was, as Wilfred Diak points out, a perfect encapsulation of the weakness of the whole US-sponsored war effort. Of those 30,000 troops, Diak claims that only 60% were properly armed, and that the total number was inclusive of barely trained women and children. He also describes the attempt of the Lieutenant General to manifest a, you know, impressive kind of command post in Kompong Spu. Quote, a claustrophobic windowless room boasting recently installed air conditioning. But although this was an attempt to emulate the well-equipped modern facilities that the US had, his was only capable of being either well-lit or being air-conditioned. It lacked enough electricity to do both. So it was either dark and cool, or well-lit but suffocatingly hot. US air power was the unspoken lifeline of this entire endeavour, along with US financial aid, and what had been reduced to around 10,000 South Vietnamese troops still stationed in the southeast of Cambodia. Terrorist attacks had begun in Phnom Penh by the end of the year, and the US embassy was targeted by the communists who had exploded a device that was smuggled in via a briefcase or perhaps a tool worker's kit. At the end of 1970, which was an eventful year, Lon Nol wrote a personal letter to Nixon. They had been exchanging these for months, and over the next couple of years, this personal correspondence would number 16 letters and 2 telegrams. It was an example of what I was talking about before, these mixed messages that are indicative of this unhealthy relationship. That while we might be easily, you know, judgmental of what we're seeing, obviously with hindsight, and we can see this is a bad path the Cambodian government was going down, and we question why all these poor decisions seem to have kept being made. But at the time, you know, Lon Nol is personally corresponding with the most powerful man in the world. I couldn't find copies of the letters they were exchanging at the end of the year, but the response that Nixon gives Lon Nol back in August includes, I guess, the equivalence of those text messages that your friend might show you when they were going through relationship difficulties, showing you as proof that their partner was actually invested, proof that you were wrong about them. Nixon begins with, quote, "Dear Mr. Prime Minister, it was with the greatest pleasure that I read your letter of July 21st. With its assessment of the dynamic forces your country can bring to bear against the communist aggression to which it has been subjected. The strong and effective defence already presented by the Cambodian armed forces has inspired my own admiration and that of the American people. The fact that the United States assistance has played some part in this defence is a source of deep personal satisfaction to me. You have my assurances that the United States intends to continue to provide support for your country in its brave and determined struggle. On the military side, we will maintain our air interdiction activities. We are now looking into means by which we may help to meet the other needs you have outlined. Let me again convey to Your Excellency my country's friendship and sympathy for the people of Cambodia in their struggle. I am confident that the Cambodian sense of nationalism and liberty, which you so eloquently described, will prevail. Sincerely yours, Richard Nixon." Now, historian's note, I did skip a couple of parts of that, but you get the idea, right? If I was Lon Nol, I would be getting confidence from that. Personal correspondence. I would feel like there was a sense of purpose there, and if I had his proclivities, I might also imbue that sense of purpose to some mystical racial idea of the superiority of the Khmer people and their destiny to protect Buddhism from the unbelievers. If we were being slightly more kind than Hang Yor's reporter friend in his assessment of Lon Nol's intelligence, we could at least say that he was quite aloof, perhaps not as diligent in his assessment of what was happening in, say, South Vietnam, as the Americans clearly saw their way out, rapidly approaching. And conversely, I guess you can go either way with Nixon here. You can assume this was all just a means to an end for him, and that Cambodia and Lon Nol was just a pawn. Or you can think that he too had some genuine aims that incorporated Cambodia into them, and he was going to try and make that happen to the best of his ability. Perhaps he truly believed in the doctrine that bore his name, and that America's allies could stand up for themselves, if adequately propped with weapons and cash. We also have to factor in that Nixon is having a lot of this picture given to him indirectly through someone like Kissinger, who may be less romantic, more cynical, and much more mechanical in his views about what was to be gotten out of this relationship. To use that metaphor again, it's like the hesitant partner still having genuine feelings, wanting to be together, but not being able to, for all these other reasons they keep to themselves. This is such a painfully old meme to use now, like 15 years ago. This was something that people would say, so apologies to the younger generations, but it's like that social media relationship status thing, right? The Khmer Republic has confidently gone for engaged, and the United States has got it's complicated. The start of the new year, 1971, provided more reality for the new Khmer Republic to try and deal with, and it would have direct consequences for the dormant remnants of the Chenla offensive, still victoriously parked at Tang Kauk, 14 miles from where it started, as well as Lon Nol's greater strategy, the politics of the Republic, and how the next acts of the dreary seven-act play were going to unfold. In the middle of the night, on January 22nd, a mortar barrage was unleashed on the outskirts of Phnom Penh. Under its cover, perhaps 100 or so black-clad Vietnamese communist commandos infiltrated the defensive perimeter of Pochentong Airport, the country's largest airport, and if you've been to Cambodia prior to the mid-2020s, you'd have likely disembarked at. You'll know just how close the airport is to the city, too, so, you know, this is something. It's also where the Cambodian Air Force had located almost all of their aircraft. The commandos spread out, sneaking from plane to plane, placing explosives on each. Apparently one commando even climbed on top of the terminal's restaurant and began firing rockets at the ammunition dump. Explosion after explosion began to ring out over the next 4 hours as the assault on the airport went on. The 10 MiG-17 fighter planes the government had were destroyed, along with 5 other offensive aircraft, 10 transport craft, and 8 helicopters. Effectively, their entire air force. The attack on the airbase, which claimed at least a dozen soldiers and even more civilians, and wounded almost 200, wasn't all they did either. Villages were attacked around the airport, and the naval base on the eastern side of the city, on the riverside, that is, was hit. In the days after, terrorist attacks produced explosions at key political locations, like the home of the South Vietnamese ambassador to Cambodia and the immigration office that processed Vietnamese applications. The offices of the National Electrical Power Utility were also targeted. Foreshadowing what was to become an awful normality, we also began to see mortar rounds and rockets just randomly arcing into the capital day by day. A dusk-to-dawn curfew was called on the city, and the state of emergency that had been declared was increased by another 6 months. The High Command withdrew units from the Chenla Column at Tang Kauk to reinforce the outskirts of the capital, effectively ending the offensive and ushering in a more defensive stance once again. Lon Nol, who had been only sleeping 3 hours a night, spent the entirety of the 8th of February at the National Assembly answering the questions of the legislators concerning the attack on the airbase and the defence of the country in general, perhaps at a loss to explain how his confidence of the situation, or having the support of the United States and President Nixon, was not protecting his new republic from such a devastating attack on the capital. At around 5 p.m. he returned home, had a shower. When he got out, he suffered a stroke, leaving him partially paralysed and incapacitated. Days later, after the government announced this, he was transported by US aircraft to Honolulu for treatment. Next time on In the Shadows of Utopia, we will see just how much of an effect this paralysing of the Republic's leader had. We'll see the resurrection of the Chenla offensive, and the blunder that will see it crumble. I want to thank everyone so much who signed up for the Patreon or donated to the show. You've made the production of this episode much better than what it would have been. A reminder that you can help out the show by visiting the website in the description or leaving a positive review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. We'll be back soon. Thanks, everyone.